Well, it seems like you all coordinated an absolutely wonderful lunch. Is that one of those magical lunches that just come together like that? Oh, my goodness.
Amazing.
That was really great, yeah. That was really
great. Thank you. Oh.
Thank you.
Thank you, God.
Well, I'm just off an airplane, off of two airplanes, actually, and two long waits in the airport.
Oh, no.
And that happened 10 days after a day and a half in the airport in an airplane trying to get to one little town in Texas. So I had a lot to think about and a lot of time to do the thinking in. And it was really something. In the beginning, got to the airport all set to go and all bright and fresh, and there's Sophie and her very serious boyfriend, and we're all going to go together, and we stand in line for hours because they couldn't figure out the computer. They had a new computer system and nobody knew how it worked.
Oh, my word.
So they kept calling up techs, and it was just... So we finally got out there, and we just barely made it in time, and there was a big sign saying, add 10 hours. It wasn't 10 minutes either. It was 2 hours. First was 2 hours. So we waited the 2 hours, and just before it was up, they said 2 hours more.
Yeah.
And finally, we got those 2 hours, and it said canceled.
No. This is out of San Francisco?
In San Francisco.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no, this is in Austin.
San Francisco. We did not get to Austin that day.
Never even got.
We did not get there.
Oh, my goodness.
So they said, oh, we should go home. And I thought, I can't afford to go home. It costs a lot of money to go back and forth. I can't do that. Uh-huh. So then Sophie and her friend Mickey stood in line and got all the way up and came up with a ticket. They had a boarding pass for all of us, and they came over and sat down and said, phew. And he looked at a text he was receiving, and it said canceled.
Oh, no.
All over again.
Unbelievable.
It really was. It really was. And people were doing meltdowns all over the place. Little babies were crying, and they'd been there all day, and it was... So they finally cooked up one more plane at 9 o'clock at night that got us to San Diego.
Closer.
Not very. And put us in a hotel, and then we had to get up in the morning, and early, in order to find our bags... We became very concerned about our bags because we kept changing flights over and over. They didn't know anything about the bags. They said, oh, they're probably in San Francisco. Shrug. So the kids got really hysterical. Sophie's makeup was in there, and that was really important. So we caught a flight. We actually caught a flight and got to Houston. Not Austin, but Houston. And then we had to get off that plane and wait a while in the airport and then get back on the plane and get into Austin. And then by some miracle, all of our luggage was there waiting for us.
Yeah. Finally something worked.
Something worked. But it was such a trial and such a test of John and I were speaking about patience and to see how people managed patience or did not, and there was some of both going on, and how easy it is to lose patience, to have made up your own idea about how things are going to be, and it takes a lot to plan and to cook up the whole thing, and you've got it all in place, and then it doesn't go. And some people just get so angry. It's like some personal thing is broken inside them and they're hurting. And they want somebody to blame for it. And so the poor airline people were just undergoing all kinds. They kept saying, "We're sorry. We're really sorry." But it didn't really convince many people. And it was also a kind of lesson to me to see how easy it is, if you don't care, just to let it all go and be curious about it and say, "What the heck is that? What's happening now? Really?" You know? And since there was no real reason to be in Austin that next day, there was a party that night, but it was not essential for us to be there. I thought, well, we'll miss the party, but we'll get there eventually. Of course they will get us there. And they did. But I could feel for the businessman who said, "I had a business dinner and I'm going to miss this, and it's all my future is in that dinner, and now what am I going to do?" And some woman who was on the phone desperately calling Southwest all over the country trying to set it up and wheeling and dealing, and it took her hours and hours and she never got through it to do anything. So, and the little children were the most patient of them all because they didn't have any issue, really. They were just there because their parents were there. And some of them were Army people, Navy people, families traveling to another assignment. And the kids were just, they found things to do. Not only the little dingy things, but they would just, one little toddler, she could just barely walk, went out over to the window and looked out at all the airplanes far down below. And then she started doing yoga. She was on her hands and knees and she was doing these movements that I thought, "My God, she's good." So it gave me a lot of thinking about the paramitas. Now, patience is one of them. They all belong to each other, really. They're all the same thing. You have to be strong in order to be patient, and you have to have ethical standards in order to be patient, and you have to be generous and wise, and meditation helps a lot. So they're all of a piece, really. But that... that acceptance isn't about gritting your teeth and saying, "All right, I'm just going to have to sit through this damn thing and I don't like this, but I will," you know. It's not, that isn't patience. It's what the Metta Sutra is about, of how to live with that kind of loving kindness wherever you are and whatever's going on, whatever is happening. And it's not so usual for us as we grow up. I think we feel so it's taking too much of a risk. The paramitas are, there's a kind of risky feeling to do any of those things, to be generous, even to be strong. It's kind of easier to be not so strong and to let other people take care of me, you know, the me that needs so much. So all of those things, I think, are in a kind of package of these very few notions, understandings of bodhisattva behaviors, it's called, and it sounds so grand. And thinking about it, I just see how very not grand it is, how absolutely right now and every day it is. And it's about how we live. Chogyam Trungpa has a new book out on Milarepa, on the poems of Milarepa. And it's a very amusing and very wonderful book. And he talks about samsaric life as toys. And we have all these toys. Everything that we do, everything that we think, it's all toys. We're just joshing up our minds and invigorating ourselves with television and little scooters and all the little funny things that we do.
Books,
exactly, exactly. Yes, and fancy food. You know, we don't eat monk's food. We eat really good food. And he said, some people, if they're trying to be serious about practice, think they should live a more pure life by never having to do with those things and to see them as toys and feel superior to all of it. He said, the thing that we are and the things that we are all around us are what it is. We can talk about the empty blue sky, but the empty blue sky is life itself. And we ourselves are the charge of life. We're a powerful charge of life. It's hard to remember that in hard times especially. I think we forget, oh, I don't have to suffer this way. I don't need to think about it this way. But it's an extra step. And how to get to that extra step every single time, I think, is impossible. But a kind of reason to keep trying, because it makes such a difference, not only in our own life, but in how we can affect everybody else.
Daisy.
You're noisy. Oh, poor thing. She likes doing that. That will be on this.
Okay.
The slamming of the door. That'll be good.
18-minute gap.
Well, they'll hear the door. They'll know what happened. So I'm not feeling very eloquent today. I didn't get home until 7 last night, so it was a long, long day. And it was a long, long visit, too. It was a wedding and lots of people living in one little house. And it was very fun. It was delightful in many ways, but way over what I'm used to. So it was good to stop. And I'm in the slowing down mode now, so I'm not feeling exactly eloquent, but I'm feeling so grateful for how much time I had just to spend watching how it works, just seeing, and how many of us there are. Good Lord, that airport was just one constant stream of people. Every different kind of people. Old gentlemen with long white beards all the way down to here. And beautiful ladies with very high heels and tip, tip, tip. And great little kids. And everyone trying to go somewhere. And that in itself is such a human thing, that we're always not being where we are. We're always on our way somewhere. Oh, take me out of here. And if they don't take you, you get Larry, why'd they do that? Give me my ticket. Can't live without it. And yet, actually, there's always help. I was sitting in a wheelchair the whole time, almost the whole time, in pretty much the same place in San Francisco. And every now and then a flight attendant would come up to me and say, "Excuse me, dear, they haven't left you behind, have they?" A little old lady is behind. They all got on the plane and forgot about her. So it was a very amusing experience as well. So bodhisattva doesn't mean very much in any kind of highfalutin way. I think that's my bottom line message. It's not a big deal. None of these things is a big deal. It's life, how we live our life. What kind of intention we bring to it. And how much joy we can bring to it. And that comes through practice. So what's your experience of patience? The bodhisattva vows, the paramitas. When it's not so heavy.
Do you mean when it's not a big, grand attainment, or
yes,
because I'm interested in when it's really mundane but it is difficult, you know?
Yes,
like it's great right after I come out of meditation and I'm so zen, you know, and everything works out perfectly. but then when I'm triggered in some interaction, that's when I don't really know what to do. I lose sight of how to be patient then. And then I might try to be patient with the other person, but it comes across as like really condescending, you know what I mean? Like, yes, I understand. I'm sorry that you feel that way. That's not real patience. Somehow it's not genuine, in my experience. And one thing I kind of touched upon was, wait, maybe I need to be patient with myself.
Yes. Yes.
That it's okay to be, you know, to be angry. I was like, don't try to suppress it, but I also don't want to hurt people with it. And trying to navigate that is something I've been trying to look into, you know? Yeah.
Sometimes a pause is a big help. You know Thich Nhat Hanh's way of ringing a bell in the middle of everything and everything stops. And that works sometimes in an argument. Just stop talking.
Well, that could also be, it depends. If the people you're arguing with, like quite often my family or my partner or my friends are not practitioners, or they also have lost their practice at the moment, then it can come across really, like, imposing to be like, and now we will be all spiritual, you know what I mean?
No, you could just say, I just can't deal with this right now.
Okay.
And take it on yourself.
Okay.
You know, it's your own thing, and it's just too much for you, which is the truth.
Okay, good.
Just
like
be honest.
Okay.
And then they'll, you know, you'll offer them the opportunity to really see you also, for real. Not this trying to be nice and make everybody okay, because you can't do that anyway.
What?
But it's a real good point, because we all do that. It's so much easier than, I mean, when you're dealing with angry people, it's scary.
Yeah,
and you always want to try to do things quick and get it over with so they're not so mad. and so dangerous or whatever.
Yeah.
So, but it often helps just to take it on and say, I'm sorry, I just can't deal with this right now.
Yeah.
And you'll look kind of weak and wimpy and, you know, but that's at that point what you are.
Yeah.
So, and it's kind of healthy.
Yeah. To know when to retreat.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that technique. Because then it's not I'm not trying to manage them.
No, you're not lording it over them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah. Family is hard.
Being a human is pretty difficult.
Being human is really hard.
Question, Angie. You mentioned these things come up out of life. Of course they do. Why do you think we're here, actually?
What do I think what?
Why do you think we're here? How did we get here? What is this, a laboratory for patience and anger and all the paramedicines? That's what we're burning this up. What do you think?
I don't have any foggy notion. I can't even imagine what this is all about. Except in the largest sense of things.
Yeah.
We know we're here. We know we think. We know that there are aspects of our mind that are huge and that it's not personal. That although we feel as if we're a personal little package of humanity, and in one sense we are, in the widest sense we're just an expression of this something that we can't even have a word for. Because it's so big. So I think awe and gratitude and really often amazement is how we are with that we connect more and more as we open up and become more conscious in the belly way. You know, we can think for hours and hours about it, but it doesn't nearly get anywhere until we drop out of the thinking down into the belly part and just breathe with everything. And then we're not alone. Everything is breathing all together with us. But who cooked it all up? No. They say there are many universes, and there's probably a universe that's just a duplicate of this universe, and what we're saying and doing now is they're saying out there somewhere else. Which is ridiculous, but who knows? It's crazy. Crazy and miraculous at the same time. And what the great religious teachers always come to in the end, that if you have to identify it in some way, you call it love.
I can usually have a lot of patience and forbearance until I can't.
Yes.
That's
yes.
The thing, right? Yeah, it's like until it fails.
Yeah.
You know, I think like, I'm too not funny. Think there's something else? No, buddy. You're a blow a gasket. Just to show who you are. You're you.
Yeah. Big pleasure. Yay. Sometimes it's helpful. You want to get a message across and it won't go any other way. Sometimes that works. It's a kind of communication. You try not to hurt with it. You can be strong without triggering somebody else's fear.
I sometimes think that people will
People do all the time.
Let's try you. Be patient.
Well, Trungpa calls us warriors. So it's about the warrior mind, you know, meeting the world and being able to meet it in any way that it needs.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean to go out and murder things. It just means to be really strong and to operate in a way that is healthy and useful, with kindness behind it.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of that, too, in the practice with the samurai tradition. We think
about
patience and endurance. And
well, they kind of twisted it into a militaristic kind of mind. You see it at big monasteries in Japan. They beat the tar out of those kids. It's terrible. That's not the message that Koban brought, or Buddha brought. Not the point. Wendy?
I look at pictures of the refugees in the Middle East, and I just wonder if this practice would serve one well in that situation, you know, if it offers any kind of respite or hope or comfort.
I'm sure there are some who are doing it because it would help so much. I mean, once you stop anywhere, you have the option of dropping down and just being where you are. You don't have to be in a special space, though it's nice to have a special space. But real practice is when you stop and drop down and just be present wherever you are and whatever the condition is. You know, it works in prison, I know, because I know people who take it into prison, and it helps tremendously. I'm sure it would help them too, and that a great many of them are doing it, whether they know it or not.
True, and a different flavor.
Yes, you don't have to call it Buddhism. You shouldn't anyway, I think. Even though, thank you, Buddha, for doing this, but it doesn't have to be Buddhism. It's just a way that it is. You know, once we stop driving our minds in all the ways that we really love to do, we connect with something.
I think sometimes in trauma situations, it actually helps you. It gives you a heightened opportunity to enter that place. Cause I just experienced that recently when my mom died a couple months ago, very suddenly, and I had this moment where, because my dad and grandma were my only remaining family, older than me, are elderly too, and they were not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this moment where I was just so afraid that I was just going to lose everything. And suddenly, the fear was just so much, I just, like, dropped into some other place where I was just like, oh, I'm safe because I exist. It was such a very simple thing. And I just had this experience that everybody I love could die, but I would still exist. So I was okay. And it was this weird kind of peace, but it was caused by the trauma. You know what I mean? Whereas in my daily life, because things don't hurt me that much, I'm not forced to examine the constant low-level pain that I'm carrying. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I do. The practice obviously helped all the time that I spend and listening to all these talks and things. But I've seen other people do like my brother did it, and he doesn't practice, you know. So yeah, I think I don't know. All kinds of interesting things will be happening to those people that we don't really know about.
Yes, and it's not easy. It's not easy at all. No. It's horrible.
Too bad more of them won't be coming here and teaching us and sharing their experience.
Well, we may end up being like that too.
Yeah,
true.
We may. That's,
well, let's not.
And if not us, if not us, our children or our grandchildren might end up being like this. You know, we live this wonderful bubble where we've been so fortunate, so incredibly fortunate that we can be grumpy about everything.
Yeah, that's so true.
But the possibility of neighbor turning on neighbor is always there. And if the construction of the, if the framework of the civilization begins to crumble for one reason or another, people do not behave very nicely anymore. And everybody's at risk. You just have to accept that. What we have is really quite wonderful compared to a lot of alternatives, and it may not last.
But there's something kind of lovely about being in the worst case scenario.
Yes.
Because I think sometimes we live in the fear of it all the time. We're like, you do everything so that the worst case doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But then when it hits you, it's like, all right. I don't have to avoid you. All right. Okay.
Okay, I can deal.
I can do this. Okay.
Yeah. Or not.
Yeah, could go either way.
Or not. And we're all going to die in any case. So that's a big factor. That our fear is often based on the assumption that if I can try hard enough, I'm not going to die. And of course, it's not true. So, in Zen, we always contemplate our death as something we need to be very conscious about, which is helpful. There was an old woman at the wedding who took me aside. She was the only, I guess she was black. It was really hard to tell. She bound her head with some kind of cloth, and she was kind of mysterious, and she said, "Oh, I understand you," even though we hadn't spoken. And she said, "Come with me to my garden." And I was... You know, we had just finished the wedding, and I said, well, she took my hand and she led me out the gate and down the street and around the corner to her house, and then started telling me all kinds of things. She's a social worker and she works for the college, and she is perfectly upright kind of citizenship and all of that, but she was so mysterious about everything. And we were talking about being alone, and she and I were agreeing that we all belong with everything, and everything is one. And I was telling her about, if you look it up in the dictionary, alone, it means all one. and she told me this funny story with which I will end. A woman had a midwife, and the midwife said she would help her if she could name the baby. So the woman said, well, okay, that's fine. And the baby boy came, and the midwife named him Alone. So when this social worker met this guy, she said, how did you get this name, Alone? And he said, well, the midwife gave my mother this name. And he said, it's really Alan. but she didn't hear it right. So I've been alone his whole life. Never changed it. So she and I agreed that alone is a good thing to be, so it's which is, that's what we are. That's what we are. Alone with it all. So thank you all.